From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Senator Debbie Stabenow on the Trump trade wars.
You have to be so careful in weighing into a trade war that it doesn't backfire on us in terms of losing our ability to sell, which certainly our farmers need as well as our other businesses.
Marketing Michigan to tourists through the ages.
The Michigans, and then the subtitle is The Almost Islands of the Great Lakes.
A hat tip to our native bees, so many varieties.
We've got little tiny bees that are about, you know, the size of a grain of rice or even smaller, and then we've got sort of the big bees like bumblebees and carpenter bees.
A Holocaust survivor tells her story.
For 4 decades, I didn't talk. Many others didn't talk. My family and I didn't talk about it, hardly ever.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today we begin with a conversation with Michigan's senior senator. From the growing trade war with China and Mexico to the pending farm bill to the accusation of sexual assault aimed at Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and more, there was much to talk about today when I sat down with Senator Debbie Stabenow.
All right, we're going to start, Senator, with President Trump's latest round of tariffs imposed on China. They really land heavily on automakers and suppliers with that 10% levy.
Right.
On over 100 auto parts, and analysts warn this could cause a downward cycle for the U.S. auto industry. So where do you see this trade war with China taking the auto industry and taking Michigan?
Well, long-term trade war is not in our interest. We're the fifth largest exporting state, both in manufacturing and agriculture. And now I do have to preface this by saying that I agree that we need to be tough with China on intellectual property rights. They have come in the past with counterfeit auto parts. I've been very involved in specific trade enforcement actions that I think we need to do aggressively. But what's happening with the White House is they are really creating upheaval in a trade war with everyone, all of our allies, not only trying to renegotiate NAFTA, but calling Canada a national security threat at the same time, then going after China, going after the European Union. They have completely destabilized the economy in terms of exporting and importing. Now, I want to export our products, not our jobs. So I want a level playing field. You know, I don't want us seeing our jobs going to Mexico because of $2 an hour wages. But this is not being done in a way that I think is going to effectively address what the concerns are, but it could cause a lot of pain.
Especially Michigan's agricultural community.
Well, they're extremely upset because our agriculture producers are very efficient and they have to have markets to sell. And they sell around the world. And one of the problems is if other countries don't see us as stable trading partners, they look to other places in the world. So our largest dairy market is Mexico, and they're now looking to other countries.
Our soybeans go to China.
Yes, yeah. And as well as dry beans and so on. So you have to be so careful in weighing into a trade war that it doesn't backfire on us in terms of losing our ability to sell, which certainly our farmers need as well as our other businesses.
Now, agriculture, we know, is such a strong focus of yours.
Yes.
And the current farm bill's provisions expire at the end of this month without a new bill. And you've been criticized by President Trump and your opponent, John James, for holding up the bill by opposing work requirements for the so-called food stamps program. Are you holding it up over work requirements?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm really proud of the fact that we passed the largest bipartisan farm bill in the Senate ever, 86 to 11. So very happy to do that. And the House took 2 tries before passing an only Republican bill by 2 votes. So there are a number of differences, both in what we call the commodity title. The chairman in the House wants to move support more towards West Texas and cotton because that's his district, rather than the Midwest and all the country. We need to have a safety net for all of our producers, and it's my job to make sure that Michigan producers are helped in this process, and so the House bill would hurt Michigan producers. The House bill also cuts conservation by about $1 billion. when I chaired the committee, we strengthened conservation to do more with farmers on water runoff, water quality. There's so many ways in which land and water conservation dollars are critical to us in Michigan. And then the final thing is in the area of the family safety net. Now, the good news is that more people are working, economy is getting better, so we're actually saving money in the family safety net. We have work requirements right now. If you're not a senior citizen, a person with disabilities, a child, or someone caring for a child, you have to work at least 20 hours a week. And if you don't, you receive no more than 3 months worth of food help within 3 years. And by the way, the average food help is $4 a day.
And so what would the house bill do to that?
The house would make more older people work, more moms with young children work, and do a number of other things that would hurt food access and add paperwork for seniors and families. So I'm not going to do that. We're not going to do it. We have a bipartisan approach. We actually, the Senate on a bipartisan basis voted down what the House did. And so it makes absolutely no sense to agree to their efforts to basically hurt Michigan farmers as well as hurt Michigan families. So I'm not going to do that. And I'm confident at some point that we will come to a bipartisan agreement.
Over to the situation with Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Ford. I know you're not on the Judiciary Committee. If they come together at this public hearing before the Judiciary Committee, what do you think it'll take to have that hearing yield anything more than he said, she said?
Well, one of the reasons it's important to have the FBI go back and update their background check, which is why Dr. Ford's asking for this and the Democrats on the committee are asking for this, is that it's important it not be just he said, she said. The FBI frequently goes back with new information, goes back to do more with a background check. It's important to interview other people that were there. And frankly, the most important person to interview is the young man who was there with Brett Kavanaugh in the room, who, by the way, has written a book about those days of extreme drinking and partying. And I mean, clearly there was a culture here of incredibly excessive drinking and partying and so on. And I think it's only fair, since he was there in the room, according to Dr. Ford, that he be under oath and testify as well. So important information. I do think it's important she be heard. It's also important he be heard in fairness, but I think the FBI should take a look at other information they can gather.
Your challenger, John James, spoke to a Christian businessman's group in May, saying men have an obligation to future generations to lead, and women prefer seeing men serving in leadership roles. What are your thoughts
about
that?
Well, we need both men and women leaders, and I would say right now the exciting thing is that so many women are stepping forward and are being embraced and supported by men and women to be leaders, and that's a great thing.
Senator Debbie Stabenow, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Great to see you.
And we've put in multiple requests for Senator Stabenow's Republican opponent, John James, to join us for an interview. His campaign has acknowledged our request, but has yet to commit to an interview or decline the offer. The founder of one of Detroit's most important cultural institutions has died. Michigan Opera Theater founder David DiChiara was 83 years old. Michigan Radio's Sarah Hewlett has this remembrance.
In the 1980s, in Detroit, there probably weren't a lot of people who looked around downtown and thought, what this place needs is a world-class opera theater.
When David proposed this, buying this building, there was really nothing downtown here. Everything was closed up, and it was, you know, to us, it was a little frightening. Are you really serious about this?
Suzanne Magliari-Acton is the assistant music director and chorus master at Michigan Opera Theater, the company David DiChiara founded in 1971. For more than 20 years, it was sort of a gypsy opera company. They staged shows at the Fisher Theater and Music Hall, but they didn't have a home of their own. So Acton says finding places to rehearse in those days was, an adventure.
One was a car dealership. One was at the Leland Hotel. We were in the ballroom. And so I distinctly remember Friday nights, it was always a bar. And we would come the next morning and have to sweep up the beer cans and everything to go into rehearsal.
This was before the renovations of the Fox and other theater venues in the city. And a lot of the city's arts patrons lived out in the suburbs.
There were a number of people that really wanted him to go to, you know, Troy.
Michael Hauser has been with MOT since 1989.
Which, you know, a lot of people at that time felt that that was going to sort of be the center of the metro area. But he always felt that, you know, culture and the arts really belonged in the central city.
DeKiera had his eye on an abandoned theater off Grand Circus Park. It had all the opulence of those early 20th century movie palaces. But the building had been stripped. Some of the roof was missing. Bums lived in the building. And Hauser says local banks had zero interest in financing DeKiera's opera house dream. DeKiera persisted, though. He got the building renovated with the help of foundations, patrons, and the Big Three. And in 1996, Luciano Pavarotti and Joan Sutherland were on hand for the opening of the Detroit Opera House. Fred Cohn is a longtime opera critic and edits Opera America magazine. He remembers coming to Detroit for one of the two world premieres the Opera House has hosted.
I've never seen anything like it.
Cohn came to cover the opening of Margaret Garner, the pre-Civil War story of an enslaved mother who killed her own daughter rather than let her return to slavery. Cohn says the audience was jubilant and fabulously dressed in a way that outshined even New York City audiences.
And what was also amazing about it to me as a New York opera goer was how much of the audience was African American. I'm sure it was at least half, if not more.
I had always said that the first opera that this opera house would present in a, you know, as a new work was going to reflect the African American community. And that I felt that this city deserved that.
That voice right there is DeKiera himself in a 2007 interview with Michigan Radio. To call DeKiera ambitious seems like an understatement. At one point in the mid-80s, he was running three opera companies in Detroit, Dayton, and Orange County, California. And in 2007, Michigan Opera Theater premiered his own work. Cyrano interpreted the story of a French cadet with a nose so grotesquely large it keeps him from telling Roxanne he loves her. DeKiera says he related to Cyrano de Bergerac, who lived his life in a grand manner to cover up a deep sadness.
And I think we do that. All of us do that in life. And a lot of us, you know, just have parts of our lives that we just, you know, are unfulfilled in some way or another.
But unlike Cyrano, David DeKiera's great desire to bring opera to Detroit was fulfilled. I'm Sarah Hewlett, Michigan Radio News.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history. Yes, Michigan, the feeling's forever. Yes, Michigan, the feeling's forever.
Beyond the forests you will see my cities rise majestically. I am Michigan. Yes, Michigan, the feeling's forever. All right, if you recognize that jingle and you started singing along, you're probably not alone. You're also probably not 20, because that Yes, Michigan Tourism ad campaign is from the 1980s. Tourism certainly part of the lifeblood of our state. Think of this, last year out-of-staters spent more than $2 billion while touring our peninsulas. But when did Michigan tourism campaigns begin? Let's find out now as we welcome the state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. So, Mark, we know the state's current ad campaign is pure Michigan. We've got, you know, Michigan's Tim Allen voicing them and the beautiful music by Rachel Portman. But what's the oldest ad campaign to try to lure people to Michigan?
Yeah, there was no song when the first one came around. We have to go all the way back to 1873, and a New Yorker named Charles Halleck wrote a book called The Fishing Tourist, and he dedicated an entire chapter titled The Michigan Peninsula and goes through blow by blow of all the lakes and streams he fished and how wonderful it was and how everybody should come here. That's also the exact time that the fish, the grayling, was first discovered in North America up near the town of Grayling, which is named after that fish. So it was this huge boon to state tourism. I mean, it wasn't an organized effort, but this gentleman just wrote a chapter and people started flocking here for the fishing. It was also featured in Scribner's Almanac. Michigan was featured in that almanac in the late 1800s for hunting and fishing. But this time period's really about specific resorts or shipping and railroad lines promoting themselves as a means to go north as opposed to the final destination or an idea of regional or statewide tourism. A great example is the Grand Rapids and Indiana Railroad's campaign in the 1870s, which they dubbed themselves the Fishing Line. And all their literature was either watermarked with the grayling fish, because that was the big discovery at the time, or a person with a fish hooked on their fishing line.
And then, so that's starting in the late 19th century. Take us through the 20th century. How did tourism campaigns evolve?
They started after we had better roads and proliferation of the automobile. Hugh Gray, in the late teens, comes out of West Michigan and starts an organization to promote tourism as we know it today. He was responsible for one of the first state slogans, Carefree Days, in Michigan. He also promoted something called the West Michigan Pike. It was a beach town tour along West Michigan. And it's the first time you see an association partnering with towns to boost their tourism. So it's really the forerunner of chambers of commerce. And then you also see these same organizations pop up in the UP, Northeast Michigan, Southeast Michigan, all following West Michigan's lead. You also see an interest in camping because people are getting out to these remote locations and they start camping, which pushes the Department of Conservation, which was organized in 1921 and is the predecessor to the DNR, think seriously about state park development, including camping facilities. And I think you also have to give a nod to the Civilian Conservation Corps, their work in the 30s that led to a lot of forest restoration and public works that are still enjoyed today.
Indeed. I remember putting in our canoe up near Kalkaska at the Triple C Bridge, which they built. So let's talk about the 50s, because the state then decided we need to get in on this and what, create Michigan Week? What's that about?
Yeah, in the 50s, the Economic Development Commission jumped on board. So it wasn't really tourism. It was more boosterism for retailers. So they created the Michigan Week campaign where they created all sorts of promotional materials for retailers, including grocery stores and grocers, promoting Michigan's produce that was created here. And the very first symbol of that was the robin. It was actually called Chesty Robin.
We use it
now at the Michigan History Center. We renamed it Proud Robin for obvious reasons, but it's what's on our admission sticker at the Michigan History Center. Mm-hmm. But all this material was just sent out, and they did different iterations every few years of the robin all the way into the late 1960s. And Michigan Week, if you're familiar with Yes Michigan, you're familiar with Michigan Week as well. It's this promotion of everything that's great in Michigan in the third week of May. It's sort of gone through peaks and valleys as far as who's promoting it. I think it's still officially run by a group down in Sturgis, but it's really sort of lost the luster that it had in the past. But in the heyday of in the 50s and 60s, they did things like they pressed 45 records to be sent out to the radio stations to be played on air, and we have one in the collections at the archives, and we queued it up and converted it to digital, and we listened to Michigan the Beautiful, which I'll let you decide whether you think this is a really energetic promotion of the state of Michigan.
All right, go. Okay, that sounds like Michigan the Dirge, the Michigan the
Michigan
Funeral.
Requiem, yes.
Michigan Requiem, pretty funny.
Well, there's always a B-side, and so the B-side to this is a jaunty little number by the University of Michigan Symphony Band. ¶¶
So when TV became mainstream after World War II, did the tourism campaigns have to up their game? What did we see?
Yeah, you saw Water Wonderland, and then it moved to Winter Water Wonderland. And one of my favorites that I don't think really caught on was one at the early 70s called The Michigans. And then the subtitle is The Almost Islands of the Great Lakes. That was a 71 campaign by the famed Detroit agency Ross Roy.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, this is conjecture on my point, but this is right at the dawn of the movement for the UP to essentially secede and become the superior state. So here you have the only evidence of a statewide campaign focusing on the two peninsulas, the Michigans.
You know, when I think of all of these campaigns, you've got to figure some politics got involved, which means we must turn to our own Rick Pluta to chime in with any war stories. So, Rick, what kind of politics might have gotten involved in these campaigns?
Well, when Jim Blanchard was governor, he took the Say Yes to Michigan campaign that had been started under Governor Bill Milliken and adjusted it. It became Yes! Exclamation point, Michigan.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was, Mark can fill me in, it was in the late 1980s, right?
Yes, correct.
And so we were leading into the 1990 gubernatorial race, and everybody knew that it was going to be Governor Blanchard seeking a third term versus the then Senate Majority Leader, John Engler. And there were complaints among Republicans and by the Engler camp and Engler himself that these promotions, both for tourism and for business, a lot of that money was being spent in state. And so it seemed like a promotion aimed at making people feel good about Michigan and the Blanchard administration and the way things were going and, you know, people, you know showing optimistic thumbs up and stuff like that. And so there was a complaint that, these promotional campaigns were also being used as political tools.
And how did that all play out?
Well, you know what? Governor Blanchard get to spend the money, but we know how the election of 1990 played out.
We certainly do. Quite a tour of Michigan's past tourism campaigns, as we've been talking with State Archivist Mark Harvey with the Michigan History Center and the political slant from our own Rick Pluta, our Michigan Radio Lansing Bureau Chief. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. Around one-third of the global food supply is dependent on pollinators like butterflies and bees. And that's why recent declines in honeybee populations have been worrying farmers and ecologists alike. But honeybees aren't the only pollinators responsible for boosting crop production. Here in Michigan, there are hundreds of native bee species playing a role in helping our food grow. Kelsey Graham is a pollinator conservation specialist in the Department of Entomology at Michigan State University. Her piece earlier this year in The Conversation digged into why we should be concerned about the health of these bees, too. Kelsey, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, thanks.
That is pretty stunning when you think that statistic you cite, one in every three bites of food we eat, we can thank bees for that. Why is that?
Yeah, so if you think about it, pretty much every fruit and vegetable that we eat that has a flower needs to be pollinated by a bee. So think about blueberries, tomatoes, pretty much anything you have in your garden that has a flower is visited by a bee. And in order to produce a fruit, you need that transfer of pollen between flowers. So you need a bee to do that. And yeah, they're really well designed for it. That's why a lot of bees are really furry. Picks up the pollen and moves them between flowers.
And they also pollinate, what, alfalfa, which farm animals eat. So they're supporting the meat component of our diet as well.
Exactly. Yep.
Well, we've heard certainly a lot of talk in recent years about the decline in the honeybee population. That's been all over the news. Why do you think we haven't heard more about native bees?
Yeah, so for honeybees, they're definitely sort of the most important part of our agricultural system just because we do manage them specifically for pollination services. So they're heavily managed. They're not native to North America, but we use them throughout the agricultural system here. So they're brought into fields specifically for these pollination services, and we really depend heavily on them for intensified agriculture. However, wild bees also play a role, but we don't manage them specifically for that role. So they're kind of like along the side of fields and definitely enter and help out with the pollination services that honeybees also provide.
All right. And as I read your piece in the conversation, I couldn't believe when I see that there are some 5,000 native bee species in North America, and we have about 465 of them documented here in Michigan.
That's
wow.
Right. Yep. Yeah, it's a lot of bees. Yeah.
Well, tell us a little about the native bees that we have in our state. I mean, what are they like and where do we find them?
Sure. So we have 465, so a large number, and they're really diverse. So we've got little tiny bees that are about, you know, the size of a grain of rice or even smaller. And then we've got sort of the big bees like bumblebees and carpenter bees that people probably notice a lot more. Those are those big fuzzy bees you see in your garden. So those are really noticeable. And then often these tiny bees go completely unnoticed by people. So I always encourage you to kind of check out a flower in your garden, watch it for a little while, and you might see a tiny little bee visit, which is always fun.
So how are Michigan's native bees doing? How healthy are they?
So that's a big kind of question mark at this point, and that's really the focus of our current research, is trying to better understand how the wild bees are doing, just because there's so much of an unknown there. We know kind of a decent amount about the bumblebees. These are kind of a charismatic species that everyone seems to like, so they've got a lot of attention from the research world, and certainly there are definitely a lot of concerns there. But for the rest of the bees, we really know so little about them. We only have about 19 bumblebees in Michigan, and so the rest of them we kind of know very little about. So right now we're kind of going around the state and collecting all the wild bees that we can find and then comparing them back to historic populations, so looking through museum specimens to see kind of which bees we had 50 years ago and which ones we can't find today. So that'll kind of pinpoint which ones we need to be concerned about in terms of a population decline, and also point out the ones that are doing completely fine.
Tell us, why is it that these wild bees, these native bees, are such efficient pollinators? What are they doing differently than honeybees?
Yeah, so one thing that wild bees can do that honeybees can't is this thing called buzz pollination. So this is where a bee will kind of grab onto a flower and shake it really fast, and this expels the pollen. So the pollen will kind of shoot out of the flower, land on the bee, and this is really good for releasing that pollen and getting it onto another flower. So this is something wild bees do that honeybees can't, and it makes them really good pollinators, and is particularly good for things like blueberry that really need this kind of shaking action to release the pollen.
So they are good, hard little workers.
yeah, definitely.
And there is some concern about, certainly, as you write in your piece in the conversation, bumblebees are, some of them are in distress. What is driving the decline in their numbers?
Yeah, so as with most bees, it's kind of a combination of factors, most likely. Certainly, reduction in habitat is probably the one that we are the most focused on right now. Bees need flowers, and a lot of the kind of traditional areas where they would go and find a lot of food, like prairie areas, are being converted into row crops, so corn and soybean. So that's a loss of food for our wild bees, but also nesting habitat. So the majority of our native bees nest in the ground. And so if this is, you know, tilled or turned into a parking lot, that's an area that a bee can no longer make a nest in.
If someone wanted to support native bees, what can we do? Certainly, if you want to have honeybees in your yard, you invest in a hive, you buy some bees. But what do we do to support our native bees?
Yeah, so again, going back to the flower thing, bees need flowers. So if you can kind of put in flowers in your yard, or even, you know, if you live in an urban area, if you can just put out, you know, some pots with flowers, that's going to make a big difference for bees. There's a lot of lists online. I recommend people going to the MSU site. So that's pollinators.msu.edu. We'll have plant lists up there, as well as additional things that you can do, such as, you know, decreasing pesticide exposure. So, you know, you don't have to always spray your yards to get rid of all the bugs. It's, you know, bugs are good. So, you know, if you can limit your pesticide use, that's great. And certainly for farmers, that's something we work with them as well to do.
Kelsey, what drew you to entomology and particularly to diving into our bee population? What do you like about it?
So bees are super diverse, and they all have kind of unique behaviors and life history traits. I'm classically more of an animal behaviorist, and I just got really attached to kind of all these unique behaviors that bees have. So it's a great system to work in, and definitely in terms of applicability now for conservation, it's a really important area, I think, to be in.
And do bees get a bad rap because of wasps?
They certainly do. And of course, you know, we need wasps too. They play a valuable role in our ecosystem, but they definitely give bees a bad name. Most of the time when people talk about being stung, it's usually from a wasp. Really only the bees that we think about in terms of stinging people most often are bumblebees and honeybees. So the rest of them, you know, the 400, you know, so species probably won't sting you. So, yeah.
And they're busy helping us increase the output of our gardens.
Exactly. If you see a bee on a flower, it's busy. It's not going to bother you. So definitely I encourage people to go watch it for a little bit, see what it's doing. It's totally safe.
Kelsey Graham, pollinator, conservation specialist, and a postdoc research associate at Michigan State University. Kelsey, thank you for sharing your love of bees with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, for decades, Holocaust survivor Irene Butter didn't talk about what happened to her family during World War II.
The change was a realization of the responsibility to be a witness, to provide testimony, to allow people to learn what really happened.
That's ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been well over 70 years since Allied troops liberated Nazi concentration camps, revealing to a horrified world the astounding scope and cruelty of Hitler's so-called Final Solution. Some 11 million people were killed during the Holocaust. Those who survived have lived so long they're now watching the world forget. A recent poll found the Holocaust fading from public memory, particularly for younger Americans. 66% of American millennials don't know what Auschwitz is. 22% had never heard of the Holocaust or weren't sure if they had. So there is fresh urgency in recording and remembering the stories of survivors like Irene Hassenberg Butter. In the spring of 1943, Irene and her family were ordered out of their Amsterdam apartment, loaded into a cattle car, sent to a holding camp, and then eventually transported to the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. Irene Butter tells her story of survival and forgiveness in her memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story, which came out earlier this year. When I talked to her in April, I asked her to start by telling me about her family, the Hassenbergs.
My father came from a large family. He had five brothers and three sisters. And strangely enough, he is the only one who perished in the Holocaust. Several of them were in camps. Several of them emigrated from Germany to South America, some to the United States. Some stayed in Germany, hidden. So I really don't understand why he was the one that didn't make it.
And there was yourself, your brother, and mom and dad.
And my grandparents.
And your grandparents, that's right, who helped you plant things. We learn about this little girl's life, and you were just five when you asked your mother, what is the black zigzag on all of those flags? The first time you noticed the swastika on the Nazi flag?
Right, yes.
And how did she respond to...
She didn't want me to see them. She said, look away, it's not important.
And I know that your family wound up fleeing Berlin for Amsterdam, hoping that that would be a safe enough distance. But very quickly, as we see in your memoir, it was not a safe distance. And the Nazi noose steadily tightened around your family. How many
changes did you have to go through as a little girl going to school? What did those restrictions feel like?
They were oppressive. Actually, we didn't experience, well, my grandfather owned a bank and that was taken away from him in Berlin. So that's why we went to Holland. My father was looking for a job because he was unemployed, and jobs were very difficult to find for Jews at that point. Then we came to Amsterdam, and we had two really wonderful years, except there was a lot of tension because Jews were being persecuted already, and some who managed to leave Germany stopped in Amsterdam on their way to other places. But still, it was a time of uncertainty. Then in 1940, the Germans invaded, and then Holland became an occupied country, and the Nazi regime took over all the rules and all the regulations.
And as a little girl, how did that change your life? What were some of the rules and regulations that have affected you?
Well, it was very difficult. We had a curfew. We were barred from all public places. Theaters, movies, parks, libraries, swimming pools. That was the first restriction. Then we couldn't be in the homes of non-Jewish people, and they couldn't visit us. My best friend was not Jewish, so we could only play together out on the street. Then we couldn't buy food. We were not allowed to enter the food stores till after three, and it was war. So there wasn't much left at that time. We had to wear the Star of David, the Jewish star, at all times. So there was no question about who was Jewish and who was not. We were evicted from the public schools, had to go to Jewish schools. And then the deportation started. So that, of course, was the worst.
And we see this through your eyes as a very small child, that people just started going away, and it was like waiting for the shoe to drop. I should note, you actually knew Anne Frank because she lived near you in Amsterdam?
Well, I knew who she was. I didn't actually know her well. I knew her through mutual friends. She was 2 years older and went to a different school.
That's stunning. And I know, as we learn in your book, you actually met up with her again briefly while you were both in Bergen-Belsen. The deportation order finally comes for your family in June 1943. And there you were, all loaded onto a cattle car for transport to Camp Westerbork. What do you most remember about that train trip and that car?
Well, that was pretty horrible. It was a very hot day to begin with. Everything we took with us, we had to carry. And we were stuffed into these wagons, these cattle car wagons, 60, 70, 80 people. No air, no water, no toilets.
One bucket, right?
Yes. So it was pretty gruesome. I learned only later that many people who were deported to the east, to the death camps, were in those cars for 5-6 days. And that just seems unimaginable to me, how one could survive.
We have a sense in reading and learning about the Holocaust of families being split up and sundered in the process. But the four of you managed to stay together in that first transit camp and also at Bergen-Belsen. Looking mm-hmm. back, does that fact surprise you, that you were able to stay together as a family of four?
Well, I don't think... I didn't expect anything else, you know, because I didn't know what was going on. We had very little information about anything. But I think one reason was that my father had managed to get these South American passports, Ecuadorian passports, and that changed our status. We were not just Jews. We were exchange Jews. And we were in a separate camp in Bergen-Belsen. Bergen-Belsen had 8 camps. And we were in the camp where most of the inhabitants had some sort of passport, citizenship, or visa to another country. And the Germans wanted to capitalize on that because they could get their German citizens back, they thought. So that, I think, was one reason. And when we left Westerbork, we were told, you're going to Bergen-Belsen, it's a better camp, and you won't be there long because you're going to be exchanged. None of that was true.
No, because in February 1944, you went to Bergen-Belsen, so there you were in Germany, and they told you it was going to be a better camp. What was it really as far as the change in your daily life?
It was very dismal, and we saw it as we entered the camp. It was terrible. It was grim. It had barbed wire fences. People were at the fences. They were emaciated. They wore rags. They looked angry, sick. So we could tell right away, this isn't going to be better.
I'm talking with Irene Butter, whose memoir is Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. If you were to think of your time at Bergen-Belsen, what sight, sound, smell, what best sums up that time to you?
Smell, for sure. Yeah, something I've taken with me for the rest of my life. The toilets were outhouses. They were never cleaned. There were just holes in a bench. People in the barracks, if they couldn't make it to the outhouse, you know what happened. I think we had 2 showers in 1 year. There were no showers in the barracks, only big public showers that they could take you to, but didn't. No soap, no hot water. Clothes were filthy. And just illness.
And they kept piling in more people. I know at the end of July 1944, there were about 7,300 prisoners interned in Bergen-Belsen. By early 1945, it was 22,000. How did that overcrowding affect the way that people were towards each other?
Well, it affected us physically because we were being moved into different barracks all the time. And then they, the beds were bunk beds, narrow, steel-framed, 3 decks, and then 2 persons to each bed. So my brother and my father had 1 bed, my mother and I had 1, but it was just a narrow bed. And then people were all around you in the beds, and this kind of crowding, you know, with lice. Mm-hmm. Lice are the transmitters of disease. And everybody had lice, all you couldn't get rid of them. They nested in our clothing, and there was no way.
And it's clear from the stories you tell in your memoir, Shores Beyond Shores, it was open game. Theft, if you had a piece of something and somebody else saw it, they thought nothing of taking it away from you. It makes me wonder, did you ever in your time at either camp, Irene Butter, did you ever witness any expression of humanity from the Nazis or from the Jewish prisoners who helped them run the camps?
Well, from the Nazis, I didn't, but my father said he once got a cigarette from a soldier, once. But I didn't see any humanity around me. If they were in an aggressive mood, they could do anything. They could beat you up. They could shoot you. You were scared all the time. Every moment was uncertain, and anxiety reigned.
And then from the Jewish prisoners who ran the camps, there's one in particular that really bedeviled you. And I have to note, there's a beautiful grace note at the end of your book where you tell us you did use a pseudonym for one of the people who made your life very, very hard in that first camp, saying this person was one of my first lessons in understanding and forgiveness. I honor that by giving her and her descendants anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
What was your key to reaching that level of forgiveness?
Well, I didn't know at first. She really had it out for me and my family. She was alone. She was, her husband had died, I think. Her children weren't with her. And I imagined myself being alone.
The idea that you got out of the camp through an exchange, I think will be startling to a lot of people who kind of assumed that everybody was just kept, and that we'll be surprised to realize that the Nazis released anyone for any reason. But you got out because of that Ecuadorian passport.
Right. It was a prisoner exchange. We got out because German citizens came in. Some prisoners, maybe. I don't know. But most of them were internees in Texas, in a camp in Texas. And so it was more important to the Nazis to get these people back to help fight the war than to kill a few more Jews.
So you did get out, and you need to read Irene's book to see the fascinating story of her trip through Algeria. No parents, no brother at that point. You were on your own. But you eventually get to the United States,
You marry. You went on to have a distinguished career in academia, professor emerita now of public health at the University of Michigan. As you were building your new life in the United States, did you talk openly about surviving the Holocaust or stuff it away?
For 4 decades, I didn't talk. Many others didn't talk. My family and I didn't talk about it, hardly ever.
So what changed?
The change was a realization of the responsibility to be a witness, to provide testimony, to allow people to learn what really happened. And so that's how I began talking to schools, in schools, to many, many students over a long period of time. That actually was one of the motivations to write the book. Someday, if I can't go to schools anymore, then my story will be available.
When you look, Irene, at where we are in 2018, neo-fascists emerging in Europe, a white national subculture thriving on the internet that is actually now out in the open. You think of Charlottesville last August with neo-Nazis parading openly. When you saw those images from Charlottesville, people openly waving that swastika flag and shouting, "Jews will not replace us," in blood and soil, did you expect to face those images again in your lifetime?
Never. Certainly not in this country. And that's why I am glad that my book is coming out now, because had I written it 20 years ago, it wouldn't be as relevant as it is today. And I think it's an illustration of how history repeats itself. And we've used the phrase "never again" for so long now, but never again doesn't happen unless we fight for it. And that's why I think it's so important that young people learn, become aware of the consequences of authoritarianism, white supremacy, ethnic cleansing, all these concepts. They should have been wiped out a long time ago, but here they are again.
And here we are with the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, telling us that in 2017, anti-Semitic incidents were up nearly 60% from the previous year. In fact, late last summer after Charlottesville, an ABC Washington Post poll found 9% of Americans believe it is acceptable to hold neo-Nazi views. What do you see at work here in our country to have this climate?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's fostered. You know, it was kind of underground for a long time. It wasn't acceptable.
Living on the internet.
Wasn't politically correct to have these views. And now it's allowed to express itself.
Why?
Why? Because I think one reason is racism. And there's also a great deal of dissatisfaction amongst people who see the country getting wealthier and wealthier, and their economic status is in decline, and it hasn't been addressed properly, as it should be.
So let's blame them, whatever, the air quotes around the them, for that inequality. Does that echo things that history tells us were spoken in the 1930s and the 1920s?
Definitely. We have to talk to them.
Is that how we keep the world from forgetting?
Well, at least it's an attempt. It's an effort. If we don't, I don't know what else would happen that would change it.
Irene Butter, author of Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. It is a powerful book and a powerful story, and it is wonderful to have you here as a living testimonial that forgiveness and survival can happen, and they are beautiful. Irene, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Chemicals commonly known as PFAS are being discovered at more and more sites across Michigan. If you live near one of these contaminated places, you probably have questions, and we want to hear them.
give us a call at 734-764-7840. Tell us your name, where you live, how long you've been aware of PFAS contamination near you, and then ask your question. We'll try to dig up answers for as many as we can. That number again, 734-764-7840. Or you can send us your questions by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. And a note before we go, today's show featured some interviews that aired previously on Stateside. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.